away from her duties without permission, and in this miserable weather.
In the next instant, Charlotte knew why. The shawls worn in a house that was warmer than most, the unrelenting preoccupation with a handsome groom, listlessness when the groom's interest faded, then a mood withdrawn to the point of melancholia.
"I've seen this before," Charlotte said, dread choking her. "She's ruined, and he cast her aside, and she's ashamed and angry. I have to stop her."
Charlotte took off across the snowy road, flung open the heavy church door, and charged up the steps leading to the belfry, knowing, knowing, knowing that she'd never get to Helwyn in time to prevent a tragedy. Another tragedy. Sherborne was exhausted, cold, upset with his wife, and reeling from too many verbal blows. Charlotte claimed she did not care about his money, but what had he to offer her other than money? She regarded his pride as problematic. What was to sustain him if not pride? She loved him? Her other imprecations had pained him, but that salvo had stunned him nearly witless, and she'd tossed it off as a commonplace. "I love you. Please take me to the posting inn." Now she'd disappeared into the church, and more blows fell on Sherborne's heart. Helwyn was up in that steeple, and outweighed Charlotte by a good 4 stone. If the maid was suffering a nervous affliction, she could toss Charlotte from the belfry before Charlotte understood the danger. Charlotte was terrified of heights, and the steeple was the tallest structure in the village. She loved him. She was the woman he'd raise his children with, and nothing could be allowed. Sherborne's feet started moving without him making a decision to pursue Charlotte into the church. Why would a woman eat orange peels, for God's sake? Why would she fall asleep halfway through a sermon that was neither boring nor lengthy? Why would she call on the Cardenwall household, home of the chubbiest infant Sherborne had laid eyes on, and neglect to socialize with any other neighbors? The stairway wound around inside the bell tower, and Charlotte's steps retreated high above.
"Charlotte, stop!"
Even if she'd heard him, she'd never obey a direct command.
"Charlotte, please, wait for me!"
Silence, and Sherborne forced himself to slow down. If Helwyn was upset, Sherborne barging into the situation like a maddened bull would do nothing to aid matters. If Helwyn harmed Charlotte, he would not answer for the consequences. He crept up the last 2 dozen steps, leaned against the wall, and, despite every instinct he possessed, waited in silence, while Charlotte, all on her own, faced yet another demon. Helwyn stood silhouetted against the frigid, whitening landscape. She was a pillar of despair, but thank God and bright red cloaks, she was yet safe. The belfry was like a balcony open on 3 sides, with bell ropes running through a sizable square opening in the floor.
"Come away from there," Charlotte said,
trying for her best imitation of an impatient Aunt Esther.
"You'll catch your death in this bitter wind, and then I will be without my eyes and ears among the household staff."
Helwyn remained on the far side of the belfry, the snow dusting her cloak with white.
"It's no good, ma'am. You don't spy on the help, and they all know what's afoot with me already."
Her voice was dead, her gaze flat.
"Who will lace me up, then? My husband abandons me at the crack of doom for the charms of his dratted mine, and comes home too tired to do more than fall into his bath, clutching yet another treatise or budget."
This complaint, though honest, merited only a sad ghost of a smile.
"You and the master rub along well enough, missus. He should not have allowed you to come up here."
Charlotte stalked around the thick ropes hanging down the middle of the belfry.
"Helwyn, Mr. Sherborne knows better than to approach me with allowing or permitting on his mind. He no more allows me to join you admiring the view here than I allow him to hair off for his mine each morning. You aren't even wearing a scarf."
And the poor woman had been crying. Tears had tracked down her pale, freckled cheeks. She flicked a sidelong glance at Charlotte, and the well of hopelessness in the maid's eyes was bottomless.
"This is about Hector Morgan, isn't it?"
"Not any more. He says he can't marry me, or he'll lose his post, and then we'll both be out of work.
The whole valley will know why, and he'll be as disgraced as I am."
The groom's reasoning was lamentably sound. Employees in domestic service were not to marry. Their entire allegiance was to be to their employers, and their wages weren't adequate to support children in any case.
"That is sheer balderdash," Charlotte said. "The man is never as disgraced as the woman. He never risks his life as a consequence of his folly, and he never spends the rest of his days paying for his pleasures. Did Hector promise you marriage?"
"No."
Halewyn swiped bare fingers across her cheek.
"He said what we did couldn't get away, because he didn't... I should not have conceived."
"He withdrew," Charlotte spat.
"Thought himself a great saint for yielding the last inch of pleasure without bothering to learn that his sacrifice was likely in vain."
"Oh, ma'am, you must not say such things."
A flicker of the old Halewyn showed in her mortification, so Charlotte took two steps closer.
"If we're not to be honest, here and now, Halewyn, then what place has honesty in any of our dealings? The child is not to blame for your impetuousness or Hector's stupidity."
"There can't be a child," Halewyn said. "I tried the teas and tisanes. I tried not eating. I thought, if I fell down the steps, maybe. But I couldn't make myself."
Her gaze dropped to the dark, wet cobbles of the churchyard 40 feet below.
"I had a friend," Charlotte said. "She was ruined by a fine lord, and didn't survive the birth by more than a few weeks. I will not let you die for something as stupid as shame, Halewyn. My family is rife with children who arrived but a few months after the vows, and my uncle is a duke."
Helwyn's consternation was genuine.
"Them as has money can marry and do as they please. I haven't any money, and Hector has only his wages."
Charlotte ventured another step closer.
"Children cannot eat money. Money does not comfort them when they have nightmares. Money doesn't stay up until dawn singing lullabies to a colicky baby. Money won't explain to a small boy how to tie his shoes or apologize for a harsh word. Money is not love," she went on. "Money is not joy. Money is surely not happiness or a kind heart or a keen mind. London is awash in money, and yet beggars abound as well. Money is not the problem, Halewyn. I have money, and you are welcome to it, but if you dash your brains out in a foolish moment, my money is useless."
Charlotte was nearly shouting, but she dared take only one more step, and still Halewyn was beyond her reach.
"I can't take your money," Halewyn said, gaze swinging back out to the frozen landscape. "I should not have done what I did."
She was a large woman. If she so much as leaned out over the railing, Charlotte would be unable to stop her fall.
"Are you to die for your mistake? Is that what Hector wants?"
"No, of course not. He wants me to go to a place in Cardiff for women like me, and let them have the baby. He has some funds, not a lot, but enough that they might let me stay there when the time comes."
"Then your baby will die," Charlotte said,
for that's exactly what happened at such institutions, all too often,
because you haven't enough coin to raise the child.
Halewyn's tears ran in silent torrents.
"I can't give up my baby, and I can't keep my baby. I don't know what else to do."
Her fingers went to the frogs of her cloak. No sense getting blood on a fine wool garment. And Charlotte moved, tackling Halewyn headlong and pushing her away from the railing. Halewyn had both height and size on Charlotte, and refused to budge. She got an elbow to Charlotte's ribs, and a grip on the railing, and all the breath left Charlotte's lungs.
"You cannot die, Halewyn! You cannot die!"
Another elbow, this time clipping Charlotte on the chin. Halewyn's cloak was coming loose, and Charlotte was losing her grip on the maid. A glimpse of the slick, deadly cobbles far below closed a vice around Charlotte's lungs.
"Let go, missus! Let go, please! Just let me go!"
Never. Charlotte forced air into her lungs, forced herself to find another handful of Halewyn's clothing to clutch, forced herself to remain upright. Simple physics weighed against Charlotte, but determination tipped the scales back to an even fight. Almost. Charlotte was determined, she was strong, and she was fast, but she was also cold, tired, and not accustomed to physical combat. Heowyn had a big, worn, wet boot up on the rail when a pair of strong arms plucked her away.
"You heard your mistress," Sherborne said. "She asked you to step back, and you will step back."
Heowyn struggled, but she was no match for Lucas Sherborne, intent on a goal. He simply held on, arms lashed about the maid, until she ceased thrashing and hung limply against him.
"Thank you," Charlotte panted. "I would have lost her."
"Miss Macpherson," Sherborne bellowed.
The vicar's daughter appeared, no bonnet, no gloves, snow melting in her ear.
"I'm here. Heowyn, you will come with me to the manse and have a cup of hot tea."
Heowyn's weeping was audible now, sniffly, broken-hearted crying that would eventually stop. The ache in Charlotte's heart felt eternal by comparison, without beginning or end, like the bleak, leaden sky. With Sherborne's arm across her shoulders, Heowyn shuffled to the door of the belfry and let Miss Macpherson take her by the hand. They left, their footsteps and Heowyn's crying fading into the bowels of the church.
"You came," Charlotte said. "You came. Thank God! You came and you brought help. I need a handkerchief, and I left my reticule."
She had no idea where her reticule was, or how she'd remained standing one more second. The village and even the countryside stretched out far below, and weakness assailed Charlotte, but not because she was too high above solid ground. She flew across the belfry into her husband's arms.
"You came. She nearly pitched us both over, nearly, but you came."
She burrowed into Sherborne's embrace and mashed her face against the soft wool of his coat and let the tears flow.
"I can walk," Charlotte said, as Sherborne carried her up the front steps to their home. "I'm not an invalid."
"You are my wife," he replied, as a surprised Crandall opened the door. "Carrying you on occasion is my privilege."
Still, he did not set her on her feet, could not, but continued straight to the library, doubtless leaving a trail of snow and mud on the carpets. He'd finally carried his bride across the threshold of their home, and that helped.
"Lucas, it was a bad moment, and—"
Charlotte fell silent long enough to lift the door-latch.
"It was an awful moment," he said, kicking the door closed behind them. "One I'll relive in my nightmares until I'm so old I can't recall my own name."
Sherborne set her on the sofa, cloak and all. Thank God that Charlotte had given orders the library fire was to be kept roaring at all times, for the room was relatively warm. Sherborne went no farther from Charlotte's side than the distance to the sideboard, where he poured her a tot of brandy.
"Drink this," he said,
setting the glass down so he could unfasten her cloak. He untied her bonnet ribbons next, and put the damned hat on the floor before the fire. Her bootlaces were the worse for being wet, and when he finally had her footwear off, he wanted to toss the damned things across the room. He set them around the edge of the sofa, where the fire's heat would do little damage.
"You don't have to drink the brandy," Sherborne said, "but I need to do something for you to calm my nerves, so you will please at least pretend to take a sip."
Charlotte held the glass beneath her slightly red nose.
"I'm well, Lucas. I came to no harm, and Heowyn came to no harm, thanks to you."
He settled on the hassock before her, drew her feet into his lap, and searched beneath her skirts for a garter.
"You were nearly pitched to your death by a maid grown hysterical over a situation that developed under my very nose. All I could do was stand outside that belfry and listen, pray, curse, and hope."
He'd also heard Charlotte's speech about money and love. He gathered Charlotte's feet and bent over them. He'd nearly lost her, nearly lost everything that mattered. Inside he was shaking, but as long as he could touch his wife, the shaking did not overpower him.
"Drink this," Charlotte said, holding the brandy out to him. "The quality is excellent, but at the moment it might not agree with me."
Did she know she was breeding? Suspect? Something in between? Had he been wrong?
Sherborne took the brandy, downed half of it, and set it aside.
"I've realized something."
"I've realized a few things, too. You first."
If she'd realized their marriage was over, and that the rest of her life should be spent under her papa's roof, rather than in a household where maids developed fatal passions for stable lads and titled scoundrels got rich off the labor of others, Sherborne would convince her otherwise.
"Branford is a disgrace of the first water," Sherborne said. "The mother of his child, the mother of his child, came to him for aid, and he all but tossed her from the steeple. Tomcats don't prey on their own young, wolves, snakes. I know of no creature under all of heaven that would behave thus."
"Branford did, Lucas. Many men do, and some women aren't much better. This matters to me."
"You matter to me."
She brushed her fingers through his hair.
"What of our offspring, whom Branford would see tossed into penury? You exaggerated for the sake of argument, but your point is valid. Branford can ruin you."
This, too, had come clear for Sherborne, as he'd listened to his wife trying to reason with a hysterical young woman, as he'd recalled that Charlotte was terrified of heights, and had scaled the highest building in the village, in hopes of rescuing a flighty maid, as he'd raced to the vicarage next door and shouted for help.
"Branford can ruin my reputation as a businessman, which reputation is overstated at best. He cannot ruin me. I can ruin your respect for me by choosing what's expedient over what's right. Only you can ruin me."
Charlotte scooted closer, emerging from her cloak to climb into Sherborne's lap.
"You say the most gallant, romantic things."
She twined her arms about his neck, and the panic that had been building inside Sherborne for weeks subsided minutely. He shifted, so he and Charlotte were in her favourite corner of the sofa. She pulled the quilt off the back of the couch and arranged it around them.
"I cannot ruin you," Charlotte said. "That was my great insight. I don't want to ruin you. I don't want to be right at the cost of your regard for me or your self-respect. You should be able to trust that one person, at least one person, will not betray you. We might argue and feud, but we must not ever fear that we'll betray each other."
"You did not want to betray the memory of your friend."
"Or the poor little wretch who has Branford for a father."
They remained cuddled on the sofa, and though nothing was resolved, Sherborne's anxiety ebbed yet more, enough that he could focus on Charlotte's words. Branford had a child, and that child deserved his father's support.
A question threaded through Sherborne's jumbled thoughts.
Radnor had clearly been the apple of his parents' eyes, Haverford a treasured ducal heir. Sherborne's upbringing had been challenging, but he'd been fed, clothed, housed, and given a name in which he could take pride. What was life like for that small boy in godforsaken Brecknockshire? What name had his mother given him, and what had he been told about his antecedents?
"What shall we do about Halewyn and Hector?" Charlotte asked. "They have been foolish, but half my family is indulged in the same foolishness without benefit of matrimony. Halewyn says those with money can be foolish, and yet her child will have no money."
"I'm thinking," Sherborne said,
which was a lie. He was wallowing in the pleasure of holding his wife, in the scent of gardenia, and in a blossoming of hope, despite the snow coming down outside. Charlotte twiddled the damp hair at his nape.
"We forgot to pick up the post, Mr. Sherborne."
"Hang the post. Very likely it will hold another scold from Branford, threatening dire consequences unless I double his money by Easter."
Charlotte's fingers went still.
"He threatens you?"
"Politely, but yes. He claims I haven't given him the opportunity to earn a decent sum in a reasonable time, you see. He has instead lent his cachet to a dodgy venture, placed his faith in a man who'd do well to respect his betters when they give him an opportunity to improve his situation."
"You can't call him out," Charlotte said, grabbing Sherborne by the ears. "There's a code about these things. He's titled and you're not, and that means you cannot blow him to bits."
Sherborne kissed her nose.
"Would ridding the world of Branford be a disservice? Would the boy be any worse off with no father than he is with Branford for a father?"
"You have the same look in your eye that you did when you came upon Needleby, trying to intimidate me into accepting his proposal. You were vexed.
Exceedingly. I am determined. I must pay a call on Haverford, and then I'd like to prepare for a confrontation with Brantford. I should be back by tomorrow evening, the next morning at the latest.
Charlotte rose from his lap, bringing the quilt with her, like a queen in an ermine cape. Haverford Castle is not an hour's journey, even in this weather. What are you about?
Cold air assailed Sherborne from all sides. Brantford has tarried in Wales, and threatened to pay another call on us, biding with Radnor if he must. He's intent on revising the terms of the contract, so I'm beggared and he's enriched. We can renegotiate that document, but I'd rather my next encounter with him be on my terms, and not his.
Charlotte nudged her bonnet away from the fire with a bare toe. Haverford is a good ally. If you must confront Brantford, you're wise to enlist his Grace's support first. But I still don't want to let you go.
She stepped around the hassock and reclaimed her perch on Sherborne's lap. This time she straddled him, the quilt settling around them both like folded wings. Charlotte, I'd rather travel in daylight, and do feel some urgency.
I feel some urgency too, Mr. Sherborne, and sunset is at least 2 hours away.
She kissed him, and without so much as a glance at the clock, Sherborne kissed her back.
Chapter 22 Charlotte hated the idea that Sherborne must go herring across half of Wales to track down Brantford, and yet, better the Earl be ambushed than Sherborne. She was ambushed by emotions so tender and raw she hadn't names for all of them. Protectiveness toward her husband figured prominently, and gratitude as well. Sherborne had fetched her down from the steeple even when he'd been furious with her, even when she'd been demanding the impossible of him. She kissed him with all the desperation and relief in her, and all the hope, too.
Sherborne drew back and framed her face in his hands. At least, let me take you to bed.
If you take me to bed, I won't be able to turn loose of you. This is a taste of what awaits you at home, should you lose your way in the wilds of Wales.
She tasted him. Tasted the determination and sheer animal vitality that coursed through him, even when he was at rest. God above, I have missed you, Charlotte Sherborne.
He could kiss and unbutton her bodice at the same time, clever man, kiss and untie the bows on both of Charlotte's chemises. She'd not worn stays, for reasons she'd confide in her husband, when next they did share a bed. Some announcements wanted rehearsing.
"I've missed your breasts. I think my brain has gone missing," Sherborne muttered, burying his nose against Charlotte's chest. "I've missed the scent of you here, gardenias and spice. I've missed your hands on me anywhere, but especially—"
She sank down against the evidence of his arousal. "Especially on your feet?"
"No, Mrs. Sherborne, not especially on my feet. Perhaps you'd be good enough to unbutton my falls."
Charlotte obliged, and further moved the proceedings along by freeing him from his underlinen. "You have missed me wonderfully much, Mr. Sherborne."
His head fell back against the cushions as Charlotte indulged in caresses she'd dreamed of for weeks. "I wanted to bring you a kitten," Sherborne said.
Were his teeth clenched? "Kittens are very dear."
"But then a kitten would have been bribery."
Charlotte arranged her skirts, took him in her hand, and began the joining. "We will talk, Lucas. We will talk later."
"Not only about kittens."
He sighed, and quiet filled the library. Peaceful sounds punctuated the silence, the soft roar of the fire, the whisper of fabric, slow kisses. Charlotte held off as best as she could, but Sherborne was intent on galloping away into the frigid afternoon. She could be selfish only so long, before the passion and longing she'd denied them both in recent weeks demanded satisfaction. She let herself fall into pleasure, secure in the knowledge that Sherborne fell with her. She'd made her point.
They were married in every sense of the word, and what she and Sherborne had joined, no pesky, arrogant earl, misguided wife, or stubborn husband could put asunder.
"This is not enough, Lucas."
Her brisk pronouncement came out more like a sigh, murmured against his shoulder.
"Not nearly," he replied, stroking her hair. "I need at least another 50 years of moments stolen with you in the library."
60,
Charlotte said.
"Wyndham's a hardy."
Sherborne used his grip on her hair to gently turn her face to his.
"You are a Sherborne now, madam. I'll thank you to remember that."
She was both, which was why she really must tell him the rest about the letters she'd sent.
"Yes, Lucas."
They remained in a quiet embrace for far too few minutes until Charlotte's eyes grew heavy.
"I can't indulge you in a nap now," Sherborne said, "though I can carry you to bed."
Charlotte sat up and let her husband retie her chemises.
"There'll be no more of that nonsense when I can stand on my own 2 feet. While your horse is being saddled, I'll have cook put together some provisions. We missed our luncheon."
Must he be so proficient at dressing her? All too soon Charlotte was shaking out the quilt and folding it neatly over the sofa while Sherborne finished buttoning his falls. Charlotte caught him in a hug, rather than face the world beyond the door.
"I don't want you to go."
"I don't want to leave you, but I've a puzzle to solve. Do you trust me to solve it to your satisfaction, Charlotte?"
He was so warm and solid, so dear, and the puzzle, the Earl of Brentford's trail of dishonour, was so difficult.
"I trust you. I'm good at sums. Puzzles defeat me."
"The riddle is simple. How do I hold Brentford accountable for his sins while keeping every single groat of his money?"
"Carefully, Lucas," Charlotte said, stepping back. "You do that very, very carefully."
Leaving Charlotte ranked among the most difficult tasks Sherborne had set for himself, and yet he did just that not 30 minutes after she'd loved him witless in the library. The snow had stopped, and travelling by daylight was imperative if Sherborne was to travel safely. Then, too, Haverford might take a deal of convincing.
"You chose an odd day to pay a call," His Grace said,
as Sherborne was admitted to an octagonal parlour.
"Are you hiding from your wife?" "I don't see your wife hanging on your coat-tails, Haverford. Elizabeth is napping, which ladies in a delicate condition tend to do, and I, being the most considerate of husbands in all of Britain, would no more—" "Haverford, this is not a social call. We are family, may God have mercy on us both. Of course this is a social call. Shall I ring for tea?" A year ago Sherborne would have been delighted to see His Grace of Haverford pouring out for him in one of the castle's private parlours. "I haven't time for tea, and neither do you." The Duke tugged the bell-pull. "One always has time for a civilized cup of tea, regardless of how disagreeable the company one finds upon one's doorstep. Stop pacing a hole in Her Grace's carpet, and have a seat." "Haverford, do not, I pray you, tell me what to do. In my present mood I might reciprocate your impertinence, and then we'll come to blows, and our respective wives will be wroth with us."
Haverford took up a lean against the mantel.
"Something has you in a royal pet?"
Sherborne gazed out the window to a bleak landscape he must soon traverse.
"I am in the presence of a monument to perspicacity. 5 entire syllables in 1 word. Meaning to count them, you had to use every finger on 1 hand. But do you know what the word means, Your Grace?"
Haverford's brow rose, and then his lips twitched.
"That's very good. I must remember to use it on Radnor."
Sherborne took the chair closest to the fire.
"Brantford was your guest for more than a week. What was your impression of him?"
"He'll not be my guest again," Haverford said. "I've encountered any number of aristocratic ornaments, but the idle and titled usually exert themselves enough to be charming, even on his best behaviour, for my Duchess tolerates nothing less than gentlemanly deportment at all times. Brantford has a subtle air of arrogance."
"Charlotte hates him."
Haverford took the second chair.
"They would not wish Charlotte Sherborne's hatred on anybody lightly. but if I had to choose an apt target for her loathing, Brantford would do. There was talk a few years ago that he despoiled an innocent and turned his back on the lady. Radnor's own mamma confirmed that rumour, and thus I accept it as fact. I could not see that such a scandal bore directly on his commercial ventures, else I would have spoken up sooner. Would that he had, instead of poking his nose all over the colliery at every opportunity. It is fact. What must a guest do in this castle to have some sustenance brought up from the kitchen? Haverford sat back and crossed his ankles. Now you're demanding your tea and crumpets. Do we blame your contrary disposition on a lack of proper nutrition? You're the one who'll want to partake. The innocent whom Brantford despoiled was Charlotte's dearest friend. Haverford stared at his feet, which were encased in a pair of worn field boots, scuffed at the toes, and in want of polish. Does Charlotte know this? She does now, and Brantford is threatening me with slander and worse, unless I repay his investment on very favourable, accelerated terms. Extortion, dressed up in lace and satin. I should have had Radnor take his lordship shooting, and arranged for someone's gun to misfire. Happens all the time in the damp.
What a delightful notion, and so simple.
Haverford, we are not barbarians. Brantford is, but I gather you know that. So what brings you here? I make a very fine second, ducal consequence and all that.
His Grace sounded uncharacteristically enthusiastic.
I'm touched, but I must decline. Charlotte says that because I am not titled, Brantford would ignore my challenge. There's also the matter of Brantford's son.
A tap sounded on the door, and Haverford got up to admit a footman bearing an enormous silver tray. The offerings included tea with all the trimmings, sandwiches, shortbread, and tea cakes. The footman set the tray on a low table, bowed, and withdrew. Haverford gestured to food.
If you expect me to pour your tea for you like some spinster auntie with a favourite nephew, you're daft. Feed yourself, and I shall do likewise. By the way, an acquaintance in Swansea tells me that Hannibal Jones's last day at the Waxter operation was the day before the shaft flooded. He'd been demanding that the owners spend the money to reinforce the tunnel, and they refused. The parting of the ways was not amicable, and they've been trying to blame Jones for the accident ever since.
You made inquiries on my behalf.
Inquiries Sherborne could not have made himself.
On behalf of the valley, spare one beef sandwich for me, and please explain how we to resolve your contretemps with my least favourite earl.
The relief of having Hannibal Jones exonerated for the tunnel collapse felt to Sherborne like an omen, an indication that determination and hard work, and some hard riding, would see his problems solved.
Determination, and a bit more help from His Grace.
Over excellent food and piping hot tea, Sherborne detailed the situation with Brantford. Haverford listened, while doing his part by the comestibles and asking the occasional question.
"So you have come here to avail yourself of a handy duke," he said, when the teapot was all but empty.
Haverford had been honest. He'd listened, he'd believed Sherborne's recitation, even when it reflected badly on a peer. And Haverford was family.
"No, actually," Sherborne said. "I'll settle for a mere duke if that's the only aid I can find. But I'd hoped my cause might instead merit the support of a friend."
Haverford brushed non-existent crumbs from his breeches.
"A friend? Well..."
He looked around as if hoping his duchess might rescue him.
"A friend whom you will owe for all eternity, even more than you already do. You do realize it's colder than hell's root cellar out there. The fresh air will put roses in our cheeks. Come along, Haverford, while there's still a sliver of daylight to guide us."
Muttering and cursing, Haverford came along as any friend would. Any good friend. The damned snow had made the footing treacherous enough that Dalrymple had called a halt to the hunting after the morning run. The post had brought no word from Lucas Sherborne regarding the colliery contract,
and the buxom maid hadn't bestirred herself even once the livelong afternoon to see if a guest might want for some female companionship. Branford was paying his third call of the evening on the decanter in Dalrymple's library when the door opened, and the maid, who'd been least in sight all day, appeared with a bucket in each hand. "Do come in," Branford said. "Can't have the fires going out when winter has announced its arrival." The library was empty, every other gentleman having gathered in Dalrymple's game-room for another evening of cards, drink, and bawdy jokes. Footmen would attend that company, else the gathering would descend into outright debauchery. What did it say about Branford that outright debauchery had lost its appeal?
"Evening, my lord," the maid said, setting both buckets before the hearth and bobbing a curtsy.
She added a scoop of coal to the blaze and replaced the hearth screen.
"Shall I light another candle for you, sir?"
Though her manner was deferential, Dalrymple himself might stumble through the door at any moment, her question held innuendo. Not invitation, exactly.
"In another half-hour you can bring some extra candles to my bedroom. I'm in the mood to read on this cold and lonely night." "Won't be any trouble at all, sir. Shall I bring a tea tray as well?"
He didn't want tea and biscuit. He wanted the Roger the Daylight out of the insolent baggage.
"Just the candles."
She collected a tray's worth of dirty glasses from the sideboard, bobbed another curtsy, and headed for the door. Before she withdrew, she cast Branford a look he'd occasionally received from his wife. Exasperation and long-suffering, along with a dash of superiority. She'd offered to bring a tea-tray so that she might end her day with two cups of good china black, none of the reused gunpowder the staff was likely to get, and a plate of shortbread, in addition to the coins Brentford would have given her. Not a stupid woman, though slyness in a domestic was unattractive.
"What's your name?" Brentford asked before she was out the door.
She stopped, her back to him, and turned slowly.
"My name?"
She'd given him a romping good time, but this request made her cautious.
"How are you called?" "Veronica, sir. My name is Veronica."
Damned if she didn't look like Veronica, too. Good breeding figure, dark hair, and that expression.
"Don't bother coming to my room. Send the footman up with the bath. And let the stable know I'll need a sound riding horse for tomorrow. You'll be leaving us, then?"
Was she relieved?
"If I have business to tend to or a call to pay on His Grace of Haverford, that is none of your affair. Be off with you before you let all the warmth out of this room."
She curtsied again, the tray of dirty glasses balanced against her hip, and withdrew. Swilling Dalrymple's brandy and swiving his help was all well and good for a diversion, but Branford had come to Wales to do business. Lucas Sherborne would soon realize that a failed colliery was only the start of the troubles Branford would cause him if that business was not satisfactorily concluded.
"Haverford will prevent matters from degenerating into violence,"
Elizabeth said, holding her needle up to the light. Yesterday's snowfall gave the afternoon sunshine a brilliant quality, making the landscape beyond the window almost too bright to behold. And yet Charlotte had spent most of her day staring out the window.
"I want matters to degenerate into violence," Charlotte replied. "Mr. Sherborne would give an excellent account of himself, having been on the receiving end of many an unfair blow. A pummeling is the least of what Branford deserves."
Elizabeth dampened a length of red silk thread between her lips and attempted to pass it through the eye of the needle.
"You are worried. You sound furious, but you're worried."
How could Elizabeth sit there so serenely when both husbands were off on such a momentous errand?
"I'm both. Why aren't they back yet?"
Elizabeth had appeared immediately after breakfast, her work basket in hand, and she hadn't budged much since. She jabbed the needle into the arm of the sofa and set the thread aside.
"They had some distance to travel if they were to meet with the Earl of Branford, and that assumes he's still at Dalrymple's hunting party. Might you stop pacing, Charles?"
"Pacing helps me refrain from throwing fragile objects and using foul language. I need a parlour like yours in a high tower, so I can keep watch over the approach to my castle.
Elizabeth closed the lid of her work-basket.
"Your pacing has tired me. I must beg the use of a guest room, for a short respite will soon befall me, whether I find a bed or not."
"The fatigue hits me the same way," Charlotte said, nudging a candlestick to the exact centre of the mantel.
"One moment I'm fine, my thoughts trotting along where I send them. The next I can't keep my eyes open, and my mind has turned to a quagmire. I've put a guest room in readiness, because you will please spend the night here, if the men aren't back by supper."
Elizabeth rose.
"Charlotte, what are you saying?"
"Gracious angels."
"Nothing, until I've had a certain discussion with Mr. Sherborne."
Elizabeth hugged her.
"As it should be. Then you will have a certain discussion with me. Biddy and Lady Radnor will join us, and we'll be merry and quite frank. Then our menfolk can have a turn cosseting us."
She went on her way, a duchess in love, and also a dear sister. Charlotte took Elizabeth's place on the sofa, threaded the needle with the red silk, and prepared to embroider a damned rosette on a dratted handkerchief, when a knock sounded on the perishing door.
"A visitor, madam," the butler said. "The Earl of Brantford. I beg your pardon, I thought the Duchess was with you."
Brantford was here? Then where was Sherborne? Charlotte remained seated.
"Her Grace will return shortly. You may show his lordship in, but please leave the door open and keep yourself and our two largest footmen within earshot."
"Mr. Sherborne might not—"
"Mr. Sherborne is from home, and I am mistress of this household. Show his lordship in, and do not think for one instant to bring us a blasted tea-tray."
"Yes, madam."
Charlotte got up, fetched the fireplace poker, and tucked it on the far side of the sofa. The idea of breaking Brantford's arm, his ankle, or his nose was unaccountably cheering. When Brantford came strutting into the room, she was again seated, embroidery hoop in hand.
"Mrs. Sherborne, good day."
The Earl offered her a perfect bow.
"You make quite the fetching picture by the window. May I inquire as to whether your husband will be joining us? I saw no evidence of work whatsoever at the colliery, and I regret that my errand is one of business, mostly business, though a spot of tea would be much appreciated, of course."
He beamed a smile at her. Charlotte smiled back, because she had entrusted justice for the Earl to her husband. And while everything in her wanted to bash the poker over Brantford's arrogant nose, she resisted. She could not, on her own, hold Brantford accountable, which meant her best option was to make small talk and simper. I hate to simper. She hated Brantford far more.
"Given the weather, perhaps you'd prefer a tot of brandy," Charlotte said. "When Her Grace of Haverford joins us, I'll order a tray, if that would suit."
His lordship marched straight to the sideboard.
"Her Grace is here. I did drop in at the castle, but was told their Graces were from home. I'll be in the area for another day or so, and must prevail upon Haverford for a bit more hospitality."
"The hell you will."
"I doubt that will suit, my lord. His Grace is, like you, travelling on business, and the Duchess is biding with me here."
He downed an entire glass of brandy and refilled it.
"I'll content myself with Radnor's company, then. I hope I'm not overstepping when I say that I was surprised that a Wyndham would end up married to such as Lucas Sherborne."
He twinkled at her, sharing a jest between aristocrats.
"Mr. Sherborne and I are quite enamoured of each other," Charlotte said,
meaning every word. Brantford guffawed, then treated Charlotte to an insolent inspection.
"Did he tell you that? My dear, he wanted his brats playing with the children of your titled siblings. Two sisters married to dukes, and you think Lucas Sherborne offered you a love match? Women are such fanciful creatures."
Charlotte's hand slipped down to grasp the poker.
"Insult me all you please, my lord, but malign my husband at your peril. He and I are most assuredly a love match."
Brantford studied the portrait over the fireplace, which had been done shortly after Sherborne's parents married.
"Your husband comes from a long line of shopkeepers and tradesmen, and it's all but established fact that his great-grandmother was not, as they say, Church of England prior to her wedding. "'You have quite married down, Mrs. Sherborne. "'I suppose you know that you are putting a brave face on a mesalliance. "'I might have to ruin your husband, by the way, socially at least. "'I doubt I have the patience to ruin him financially. "'This is very good brandy.'
"'Charlotte rose from the sofa, rage, a frigid river in her veins.
"'You come to Mr. Sherborne's house, swill his brandy, with all the delicacy of a great ape, insult me, insult my family, and insult my husband. The only thing that keeps me from doing you a serious injury is the fact that I esteem Mr. Sherborne too highly to befoul his carpets with your blood.
Brantford chortled, until Charlotte held the poker up like a riding crop.
I like a woman with some spirit,
Brantford said, setting his glass aside.
Perhaps you'll wish to choose your words carefully,
Sherborne said from the doorway,
for you're in the presence of an innocent child.
Charlotte lowered the poker.
Mr. Sherborne, greetings.
Clinging to Sherborne's hand was a small blonde boy. The child had Fern's chin and her nose, though Brantford's contribution was apparent in the flaxen hair and blue eyes. Haverford strolled into the room.
"'Perhaps I should take the boy to the kitchen, where we will ask cook to make us a pot of chocolate.'
The child's gaze bounced from Charlotte to Haverford to Brantford.
"'He've never had chocolate.'
The boy spoke Welsh, so Charlotte replied in the same language.
"'Chocolate is a very rich drink, so be sure to add a dash of sugar. Your mamma always took it with a dash of sugar.'
His smile was entirely Fern's.
"'You knew my mamma?'
Charlotte nodded, rather than trust her voice.
"'Civilized people speak English,' Brantford snapped.
Sherborne knelt so he was eye-level with the boy.
"'Haverford will steal all the sweets if you let him,' he said in Welsh. "'He has a very pretty duchess who might join you in the kitchen. She'll make sure you get your fair share of biscuits.'
"'I heard that,' Haverford said, also in Welsh. "'And you heard the lady, Sherborne. Mind the carpets.'
"'We'll talk later,' Charlotte assured the child. "'I'll tell you all about your dear mamma.'
Then they were gone, the boy flicking one mildly curious glance over Brantford before taking the Duke's hand and skipping off to the kitchen. Brantford gulped down the remaining portion of his brandy.
"'I haven't the least notion what that farce was about, Sherborne, but you and I will come to terms regarding my investment in your little colliery, or I'll see you ruined down to the 19th generation before next year's season begins.'
"'We'll renegotiate,' Sherborne said, thrusting his hand into a pocket. "'Let's start with an explanation for this miniature, given by you to my wife's best friend, her late best friend, who was the mother of your only begotten son.
How do I hold Brantford accountable for his sins, while keeping every single groat of his money and denying my darling wife the pleasure of drawing his lordship's cork? Brantford stared down at the miniature Sherborne had placed on the sideboard.
You claim that is a likeness of me?
He reached toward the portrait, but withdrew his hand, his shaking hand, without touching it.
"'You initialed it,' Charlotte said. "'Look at the back.'
He managed to pick up the miniature and stared at the back while Charlotte glowered at him. Brantford sank into the chair before the hearth and held the miniature out to Sherborne.
"'Take it. Take it, please. I never want to see it again.'
Sherborne remained beside his wife. Lest that good woman start laying about with her iron poker.
I recognize your penmanship, Brantford, having seen it on the contract you signed. You gave that portrait to one Fern Porter, whom you enticed into a liaison, though she was a vicar's daughter and innocent of men prior to her association with you. After you proposed marriage to her, she conceived a child and informed you of her situation. You struck her, turned your back on her, and married another.
Brantford set the miniature on the low table.
I was young, not much more than a boy.
You had finished university years earlier,
Charlotte spat. "You were an adult. She was just out of the schoolroom, and you ruined her. Promised her undying love, promised her marriage, and played her false."
Brantford took out a lace handkerchief and dabbed at the corners of his mouth.
"She should not have—" "Don't," Sherborne said.
Charlotte had raised the poker. She shot a quizzical look at her husband.
"I spoke to the Earl. You, Mrs. Sherborne, must do as you see fit. I admonish his lordship not to compound his sins by minimizing his own faults, lying, or casting blame. He ruined a young woman, made no reparation for the harm done, and now she's dead, leaving an innocent child all but orphaned."
"I wasn't sure,"
Brantford said, using the handkerchief to mop at his brow.
"How was I to be certain she wasn't deceiving me? How is a man to know?"
"Mr. Sherborne," Charlotte said, passing the poker over to Sherborne, "I cannot trust my self-restraint in the presence of such vile, cowardly, spineless, dishonourable, disgraceful, weak. The entire language lacks enough adjectives to convey my contempt for you, my lord. Your son is lucky that he's growing up without a hint of your presence in his life."
Brantford hunched forward, as if Charlotte had struck him physically.
Sherborne held his peace, because clearly the lady had more to say. "Fern suffered," she went on. "She suffered scandal and disgrace. She suffered through a confinement with no physician to attend her. She suffered an awful birth, her pangs going on for days. She suffered yet more, knowing she would not live to see her child grow up, knowing nobody, not her, not the miserable coward the child must claim as his father, would love this child the way he deserved to be loved. So much of her suffering is your fault, and I hope you are repaid tenfold for your despicable selfishness."
The winter wind was balmy compared to Charlotte's tone. She sent Sherborne a look, then made a grand exit from the parlour. "Finish the job," that look said. "Find justice for Fern and for the child."
"Haverford has offered to aid me in arranging your ruin," Sherborne said, setting the fireplace poker just so on the hearthstand. "Radnor will want to do his part, and my lady wife counts any number of well-placed relations on her family tree. I suspect she has written of your irresponsibility to every one of them. I cannot put a bullet between your eyes. That would be too easy, and make the boy an orphan, in truth. But I can make you regret your treatment of Fern Porter every day of your miserable, titled life."
Brantford sat up and put away his handkerchief.
"Might I have some brandy?"
"You came here expecting to all but extort funds from me. I owe you nothing in the way of hospitality, much less fairness."
His lordship studied the miniature on the table, his gaze growing sly.
"I'll just collect the lad and go. Keep the damned money. I don't need it."
"And the boy does not need you."
"Now see here, Sherborne. That child is my blood. My only begotten son, you said it yourself. The likeness is undeniable, and I'll not have you interfering."
Brantford drew righteousness around himself like presentation robes, his sense of entitlement so ingrained, not even shame could dislodge it.
"You denied any responsibility for him," Sherborne said, "and in the face of your callous disregard for the child, my wife provided for him. She convinced an uncle to take in both mother and child, sought a Fern's safe travel from London, and has been sending money for the child since before he arrived into this world. You have no claim on that boy, legally or otherwise."
Brantford rose and jerked down his waistcoat.
"He is my son. I am a peer of the realm, and you will not deny me a father's rights."
Thank a merciful God that Charlotte wasn't on hand to witness this hypocrisy.
"You are a perfect donkey's arse. Sit, Brantford, now."
His lordship evidenced a modicum of prudence and sat.
"You don't understand, Sherborne. I haven't any other children."
"Such a pity."
Sherborne marshalled his best imitation of Haverford into a genteel rage.
The child had only the one father who might have made his mother's circumstances easier, a father who could have seen to it she had proper care and assistance at her lying in. That same father might have spared a few coins for the child, might have given the child his name. Alas for the boy, the one father responsible for bringing him into the world is too busy, being a peer of the realm, to be a decent human being.
Damn it, Sherborne, there won't be any other children. The physicians don't come right out and say it, but a touch of the French pox can have lasting consequences. That child, he'll never have the title, but I could acknowledge him eventually.
Had Brantford asked anything about the boy, his name, his present state of health, his uncle's financial situation, Sherborne might have weakened. But Brantford clearly saw his offspring as proof of virility, a social accessory or an ornament. Truly, young Evander was better off without that version of a father's interest.
"This is how we shall proceed," Sherborne said. "You will place your shares in the coal mine in trust for the boy now, and sign them over to him at age 18 if they haven't been liquidated."
Brantford wrinkled his nose.
"Any legitimate Welsh pauper has no use for shares in a mine."
"He has no use for a negligent father. The trustee managing those shares will be His Grace of Haverford. If Haverford is for any reason unable to serve as trustee, Radnor will step in. They will further acquaint their ward with the details of his birth at an appropriate time. You will be given quarterly assurances of the child's good health and educational progress."
"Haverford is taking a hand in this?"
"And Radnor."
"My friends, who will be guided in all particulars by my wife." Sherborne went to the window, where bright sunshine had started to melt the snow. As the sun set, the lanes would freeze anew, and travel would become treacherous.
"At least I'll be supporting my son."
Brantford was on his feet again, the miniature in his hand.
"Let it not be said that when given an—"
"Do we add larceny to your list of transgressions?"
Sherborne asked.
"That painting is not yours, and no one has given it to you."
That portrait was also the primary evidence connecting the child to the Earl, and Brantford's attempt to make off with it was proof positive of inextinguishable self-interest.
"You can't have any use for it," Brantford retorted.
Sherborne prowled across the parlour, glad that he wasn't holding the iron poker.
"Put it down, Brantford, or you will suffer a bad fall on my main staircase. Drink makes any man clumsy, and there's not a servant in this household who will say otherwise."
Brantford set the portrait down slowly.
"You are not supporting the child."
Sherborne had just now made that decision.
"I am supporting the child. Haverford and Radnor are overseeing the assets you'll convey to the trust. I want that young man to know that he owes you nothing. Not one bent farthing. If he chooses to toss the mining shares back in your face, that will be his decision when he's of age. If he chooses to write to you or visit you in London, that will be his choice. He owes you nothing, and never will."
Brantford huffed. He plucked at the hem of his waistcoat. He looked down his nose, or tried to, despite Sherborne's superior height.
"And if I should take this matter to the courts?"
"What an ass."
"Please, take this matter to the courts. My uncle-in-law has lunch with a Lord Justice, at least monthly, and I can call upon more barristers and solicitors than you have hounds in your kennel. By the time you stand before a judge, the boy will be through university. But indulge in all the legal dramatics you please."
Sherborne opened the parlour door and swept a hand toward the corridor.
"Just know that your only son will be well cared for, despite your negligence, because my wife stood by her friend even when you, with all your means and consequence, turned your back on a woman in need and her helpless child. Now leave, before I toss you down the jakes like the offal you are."
Brantford stalked out, and Sherborne followed, waiting at the top of the steps until the Earl had quit the premises and the butler had closed the door behind him.
"Mrs. Sherborne is in the kitchen, sir," Crandall said. "She said they'd save you a biscuit. Cook is having an apoplexy because His Grace